Hey, this is Michael Emery. Thanks for tuning into the Slow Baja. This podcast is powered by Tequila Fortaleza, handmade in small batches and hands down my favorite tequila. Hey, I want to tell you about your new must-have accessory for your next Baja trip. Benchmark Maps has released a beautiful, beautiful Baja California Road and Recreation Atlas. It's a 72-page large format book of detailed maps and recreation guides that makes the perfect planning tool for exploring Baja. Pick yours up at benchmarkmaps.com. Hey, I just want to let you know I am super excited to bring you today's show with the godfather of off-road racing, Sal Fish. But before we jump into that, I need to say thanks to Lyman Schur for connecting me to Sal. Some of you may know Lyman. He's a pretty well-known guy, Baja-loving car builder and restorer based down in Arizona. I first met him in 2018 when the fabulous Kelly Whitten was running the Copper State 1000, and I was lucky enough to be driving a beautiful Datsun 240Z in that amazing event. Datsun, as Mary McGee would say. At the beginning of this year, Lyman was prepping Big Ole for its run in the Slow Baja Safari class, and I happened to be down in Arizona watching my son Rob in spring training, so I reached out, and Lyman was so generous, had me over to the shop, showed me Big Ole up close and personal, every little detail, and even invited me to stick around for the weekend where BJ Jones was going to be giving it its first shakedown run. It was amazing. Anyways, for lovers of off-road racing, Sal Fish needs no introduction. In our conversation, we go deep into his life before he became a legend. We hear about his childhood, growing up in L.A., the son of a kind and humble auto mechanic father and a loving stay-at-home mother, parents who pushed Sal and his brothers to strive for a better life. They stressed the value of a college education. In fact, we go pretty deep into Sal's days at University of San Francisco. He was there at an amazing time, and he... By his own admission, he had an amazing time when he was there. I'd hoped to get Sal on as my 100th Slow Baja conversation. That honor befell Coco, R.I.P. Coco, but I put our conversation off until my move to Chicago was complete and I could really make some space for a serious discussion. And Sal invited me to stop by his place in Malibu on my way back from the Nora 500. And as you know, guests on Slow Baja usually receive a benchmark map, road and recreation atlas, but since Sal is a noted tequila aficionado, I brought him a bottle of Fortaleza Blanco. Well, we sipped a little after I stopped recording, and I hope to get him back on the show soon, as I think we talked for more than an hour, and we only got up to 1969. So anyways, without further ado, I bring you my new amigo, Sal Fish, the godfather of off-road racing. Well, hello, amigo.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Great. It's
I should say, buenas tardes.
Yeah, it's a beautiful morning here in Malibu. Spectacular. The sun's going to come out in a few minutes, still a little gray out. And I'm with the godfather of off-road racing, and I'm just thrilled to be sitting here with you, a couple of microphones. And I really just, I just want to get the great history that you've lived firsthand and get it for the Slow Baja audience and get it for posterity. So, Sal, thanks for having me.
Well, Michael, thank you. And I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your podcast. I know it's a global event, and just a few, let's say, hours we've had before we're starting this. It was a pleasure hearing some of your background, and I'm just wondering how I'm going to be able to interview you for your podcast so your listeners will hear what an exciting life you have. My God, it was just, you know, you had me in awe.
This is how Sal does it. He starts with flattery, and then he just comes in hot. Well, we'll get to you interviewing me later, but I really am touched. I've done a lot of research on you since we first met at the Nora Mexican 1000 last April, and we're here at the beginning of October. So we met a few months ago, and I really was taken by the conversation we had. And it was just a casual conversation. We sipped a little Fortaleza. We talked about your days in USF, University of San Francisco, and you were at that school at probably the pinnacle of its worldwide acclaim for basketball, with Bill Russell, RIP, who's passed away sadly, but a great time to be in San Francisco, a great time to be at that school. And it got me thinking about the arc of your life. So you start off born in 39.
Yeah? That's correct.
In Los Angeles.
That's correct.
Son of an immigrant.
Well, his parents.
His parents.
So. My dad actually was born in Los Angeles. My mother's mother brought her over from Sicily to New York, had her in New York, and left her there after she was only 2 months because she couldn't stand America, and left her with her her husband, her mother's father, who was spoke very little English, and he was commissioned by one of the famous big department stores, and I don't remember the name at the moment, in New York, and he did gold leafing on frames, picture frames. That was his artistic thing, and so he raised my mom, and they left New York to come to Los Angeles when she was about 1 year old. And so you could say both my parents were, born in Sicily in the United States, and the rest of the family was from Sicily. So, but you know, it is kind of an amazing thing because not too many people started off what you just said about Bill Russell and Coach Phil Wilpert. They were a phenomenal thing. Unfortunately, the scandal that happened with the payoffs that the University of San Francisco, which is a Jesuit college, which was the farthest thing in the world, you'd think that the Jesuits and the Catholic faith would be doing something like that. But I'm not sure if the powers to be at the school really realized it. But the whole University of San Francisco thing is, as you're saying, it was the most unique place to be at that time, and especially San Francisco itself, because I went to grammar school here in Los Angeles, Catholic school, Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet. Then I went to Loyola High School, which was a Jesuit school, and so I have quite a few years of Catholic education, and I had, without a doubt, probably the greatest parents a kid could ever wish for. You know, my dad had an automotive repair shop in Los Angeles. My mom was a homemaker because I have three brothers. Two were older and one younger. My oldest brother was about 7 years from me. Then the next one was six. And then Anthony, my youngest brother, was 10 years difference between me. So we had a very unique, nice family that loved America. My grandmother, who would not speak English, lived with us. My mother and father took care of her, and she was always wanting us to speak Italian. Our parents wanted nothing to do with them speaking Italian. We were in America, and you spoke the language of America. So I was blessed, having a good grammar school and good high school education and great brothers and mom and dad. But the unique thing was I really wasn't a student. My two oldest brothers were fantastic. My oldest brother actually ended up going to the seminary, and he had about a half a year. He was in Spain, Burgos, Spain, becoming a priest. He had about a half a year to go, and he decided, he didn't want to be a priest. So, and can you imagine, every Italian family knows that one of their sons is going to be the Pope, and here was our answer to it, and my grandmother about died on the spot when she felt he wasn't. But he turned around, came back to Los Angeles, did the same thing with dentistry. He decided he was going to be a dentist, and about 6 months before he took his final exam, he just said no, he didn't want to do that. He went into the service, and the only reason I'm talking about this is I think he was a role model for me. I mean, he's just a great human being, but he was very intelligent. He spoke seven different languages and became a very noted attorney here in Los Angeles, and just a great brother. My next brother, Tom, same thing. He went to Vietnam and then came home and became a titan in a company called Universal Match Corporation and traveled the world. And it was not only about matches, they did pumps for all major construction stuff and everything. He sold pumps in China and everything before you're allowed to go into China. So I had a real role model. But growing up here in Los Angeles, my dad had his automotive repair shop, and he did not want any of us to become mechanics. He wanted us all to have a college education, and all of us did get college educations, and he wanted us to do something other than being a mechanic. And that's nothing against being a mechanic, but he wanted his kids to have a college education. And so I wouldn't say I was a gearhead at all. I saved $400 by having about three different jobs when I was in high school so I could buy my first car, which is a 47 Ford convertible. And I got that when I was 14, so I had a year and a half to work on it, which I did. I took it down to my dad's garage, and I pulled on the weekends and sometimes after school, pulled the engine apart. And I wasn't, as I said, a gearhead, but my dad and the mechanics that worked for my dad helped me. And I rebuilt that engine and polished and hand-touched every part of that car. And I can remember we lived on Santa Barbara in Western, which is now Martin Luther King Avenue, and it wasn't too far from the Coliseum. And I could ride my bike, you know, from there to the Coliseum, and I could back up my car in the driveway. And I couldn't, my mom and dad wouldn't let me put a tire out on the street because it wasn't legal, you know. And so I had a year and a half of just backing up and going forward and dreaming the day that I'd get my learner's permit and someone would come with me and I'd be able to drive. And that was the extent of my really mechanical ability, so to speak. And then it was time to graduate, and this is 57. And you could, if you're an old timer listening to this, you know, Southern California and Northern California really could have been two states because we were still hanging people in the streets back in the 40s and 50s. And it was cowboys and Indian type thing. San Francisco was a financial center of California. Guys wore suits and ties, women wore hats, and they went to
and gloves,
you're exactly right. And they went to the opera, and you know, Southern California was looking at, you know, Tom Mix and Flash Gordon movies and kind of in Hollywood kind of stuff. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I really didn't have the grades to get into college, but the president of Loyola High School at that time, and if you know anything about Jesuits, they're not your typical Catholic educator. They're usually guys that went out in the world and later on in life found their calling to be with, you know, religion or instructors. And the president at that time was an ex-Marine, and he was a Jesuit. And he called me in before we graduated and said, you know, I've got a friend that's the president of the University of San Francisco, and I think he'll do me a favor if I give you a letter of recommendation, because I could, to be honest with you, I couldn't get into any college. I don't care what it was. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no clue, really. I was figured, well, I was body surfing at the time, and I thought that was the whole other end of life. And he wrote a letter to the president of the University of San Francisco, and they actually took me up there on probation, that if I could get a C average, I can continue going there. Well, no one from Southern California, or especially Loyola High School, went to the University of San Francisco. They either went to Gonzaga, Berkeley, or Stanford, or Santa Clara. And so I was the first individual to go from Loyola High School to the University of San Francisco. And I just packed up. I had a Baja Bug at the time. I packed it up, and my folks were just blown away that I was going to leave town. I said, well, I'm going to go up there and try to make it. So I drove up to San Francisco, and it just was just such a beautiful city. And I lived in the dormitory there for the first 6 months, and it was a very unique school at that time. It wasn't the school it is today. You know, there was a lot of older people going to school there. It didn't have the academic, I don't think, standards at the time. Was a world-class university, but and the people from San Francisco really supported it, and it was in one of the most beautiful spots in San Francisco there on Golden Gate and Masonic, you know.
Yeah, but even if you were smart and went to St. Ignatius High School in San Francisco in those days, the smart kids ended up at Santa Clara.
That's correct.
Yeah, you ended up at USF if somebody was talking to one of the brothers or, you know, needed to do a favor.
I
don't mean that in a derogatory manner at all.
I don't, you know, my wife
hates it. It was the hometown school.
Yeah, hates to hear this story because she's an educator, and it embarrasses her when I tell her about, you know, how I really wasn't a student. You know, she knows who I am. But I just, for some reason or another, I got in with the you know, there was, I think there was, Phelan Hall was the name of the dormitory there. And the basketball coach then, it was Phil Wilper, and I played basketball, in Loyola High School. And, you know, you could see me now, I've shrunk 2 inches. I was 5'10", so no big deal. You know, I was a shooting guard, you know, so I...
But not 6'10".
No, not 6 foot. I didn't shrink that much, you know. So anyway, bottom line was, during the day, after a class or something, I'd go over to the gym and sat around and watched, you know, Wilper and Mike Farmer and Casey Jones and play ball and everything. And I met Phil Wilper, the coach, and the quote athletic trainer. I met him for some reason because he saw me in the gym, and I'd kind of help him with the balls, and because I could take some shots and stuff. And he says, "You know what? Why don't you help me out? I'll show you how to do sprained ankles and stuff like that." Next thing I know, I'm working with him as the quote assistant athletic trainer. And then Phil Warp with the scandal happens. He leaves, and a gentleman by the name of Pete Paletta and his wife, very nice young couple, becomes the head coach for basketball at the University of San Francisco. Now, they were on the downside because they've just been out of the tournament. They wouldn't let him play anymore because of the scandal. And Phil had to, Paletta had to build up the credibility of the university, and we hit it off just fantastically. And next thing I know, I'm sitting on the coach's bench with him, acting like I'm with him about plays and looking at the game and everything. And I traveled with the basketball team. We went all, you know, in any games or out of town, I went, you know, and I was with them, and I was still going to school. But to be honest with you, for some reason or another, the athletic program there meant a lot to the university. And next thing I know, I was spending a little more time in the basketball end of it than I was with my actual academic thing. And I'm not saying anything against the University of San Francisco, because it's embarrassing to say this, but I really was not, I did graduate, but I graduated because of my ability with the sports team there. And I matured in San Francisco. That one of the gentlemen that was the head of the, he was called a prefect at that time. He was an older guy, but he was going back to school in San Francisco. And so he was the head of my floor, which was like the third floor of the dormitory. And he was a bartender in San Francisco. And he knew, as you know, at that time, 57, San Francisco was still basically North Beach Italian influence. The bars were fantastic. They didn't have the Hollywood LA stripper joints up there. Now it was really real bars, you know, with, you walked in, you rolled for a drink, or, you know, or you flipped a coin for a drink, and you got hors d'oeuvres free and the restaurants and everything. So he introduced me to his friends, who were all bartenders and waitresses, and I got in with a very unique group of San Francisco people and fell right in with them as a Southern Californian. They thought I'd have cowboy boots, or, you know, or I was a used car salesman, one of the two, being from California, Southern California rather. Anyway, I just fell in love with San Francisco. And so I was living in the dormitory, trying to go to school, traveling with the basketball team, enjoying San Francisco. And they had an alumni association, and the owner of the most, don't laugh, but prestigious mortuary in the Northern Hemisphere called Carew and English was on the corner of Golden Gate and Masonic, which at that time was just four blocks away from Haight-Ashbury, where the whole hippie movement was in free love and everybody was smoking dope and jumping rope and having a great time. And he said, you know what? He says, as part of the program, if you'd like to not live in the dormitory, I have a suite above the mortuary.
Nice and quiet.
I'd love to have you up there, you know, as part of our alumni program. And so, boy, here I am. It was a duplex, kitchen and everything. I was the only guy there. I lived above the embalming room, which was incredible.
Can't make this up, folks.
Then another alumni, because I was now with the Alumni Association because I was in the basketball deal, said, you know what? You could use some extra money, right? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, we've got a brewery down near the airport. Want to introduce you down there. I'll drive you in. You show up on Monday, sign in, but you don't need to come back because you have to study and you have to do with the basketball team. And then show up on Friday after 3:00. You'll get your paycheck and two cases of beer. So I'm living, you know, almost like I'm on a scholarship, and I can't even figure out how I'll get a C average to stay in school. I'm getting paid, and I'm getting two cases of beer, and I'm traveling with the basketball team. Plus, I'm meeting all of the cool people in San Francisco. So I just was, seriously, it was probably the most exciting time anyone could imagine, because I was maturing and growing up in just the most wonderful city in the world, and meeting I could walk into any bar or restaurant at any time and sit down, and it's free, give me a free drink or a lunch or anything, because I was friends of that group. So my life up there was spectacular. I really met people that I think, besides my parents and my brothers, gave me a real different perspective of life and manners and ambiance and cuisine and just things that I don't think I would have gotten in Southern California in the group I was with, you know.
Yeah, and let me say something about that. You've been so self-deprecating about your grades. Maybe you've never realized you got straight A's in the people business, which is what served you for the rest of your life. The people business. You understood how it works. People made you feel welcome. You've made people feel welcome for the rest of your days and your life. So let's jump ahead. Okay. They bestowed a diploma upon you, and then you had to do something with it. How did that chapter
exactly
begin to
unfold? Well, I'm gonna have to regress just a second. In those travels, we did go to the University of Hawaii and paid the base there. And I met the commander of the sub-PAC base in Hawaii. And he said, you know, you're going to graduate at the end of the year. And I said, yes. And he says, well, you know, you're going to get drafted, right? And I said, I guess so. And he says, well, before you get drafted, come to Los Alamitos, the sub-PAC base there. Sign up for 4 years. As soon as you do that, I will send for you. You could live off base. You won't have to wear a uniform in Hawaii and travel with the team. And I said, that's great. So I graduated from the University of San Francisco, drove home, stayed at home because I was living with my parents then when I got out of school, and waiting to go down and do this interview and joined the Navy down there. And there was a little downtime because I hadn't got the drafting papers yet, so I didn't want to rush the thing. And in the meantime, I was going down to 22nd Hermosa Beach body surfing. My dad was getting up at 5:30 in the morning, going to his shop on Vermont and Wilshire Boulevard, and opening his shop. Well, after about 3 weeks of me living at home and seeing what he was doing, I said, you know what? Why don't I go down and help you, Dad, and see if I could help out? And he says, no, I don't want you to do that, blah, blah, blah. Well, I did, ended up doing that. Then I went down while I was working at my dad's to the Los Alamitos base, took the physical, and I was so excited because, you know, I'd be going off to Hawaii. Well, I was 4F. And I couldn't believe it. I said, wait a minute. I want to go on the surface.
You've got a plan.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
What are you talking about? I'm 4F. And they go, no, you've got a albumin in a kit in your kidney, and you need to see a specialist. And I was so bummed out. I couldn't, because I felt great. You know, I couldn't believe it. And it was just, I think, the tough life, exciting life I was living in San Francisco, drinking, having a great time.
You caught that at the Basque Hotel? Is that where you caught that?
Yes.
At the Blue Fox, maybe?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Paoli's, San Francisco was incredible. I mean, it really, the Condor, before it became Carol Doty's, that was a real mafia Italian thing. I used to go in there, just knew all the guys, had great, great times. We used to do everything there was. So bottom line was, I was 4F. I just was in a bummer. And the next thing I know, you know, I go to Rochester Carburetor School. I go to Transmission School. I go to Bendix Brake School. I'm working with my dad as a mechanic. And, you know, before I was wearing a suit and tie and being Mr. Cool. And now I'm in, you know, mechanic outfit, getting greasy and everything. And I really wasn't a mechanic, but I was kind of, I could do brake work. I hated transmission work. It was way over my head, you know. And I kind of managed my dad's garage and let him ease up a little. So I lasted, let me see, I was 61 to about 4 years or whatever it was. I kept on Sunday morning. I'd go to the beach and surf with some guys. And one Sunday, one of the new guys that came into our group was Dick Day, and he was the publisher of Carcraft magazine at Peterson. And about two Sundays after meeting him and talking to him, becoming a little kind of friends, he said, you know, I don't think you're a mechanic. He says, you want to be an ad salesman? And I said, well, I'm certainly not an ad salesman. I have a degree in industrial relations, right? I said, I have no idea. And he says, well, I'll teach you. And I went back and told my dad, and he was so happy to hear this. He said, Sal, God, it's not that I don't want you in here, but you need to do something better than being what you're doing here. And so I went to Peterson Publishing Company, suit and tie. He was a very good Dick Day. And back that, you know, Bob and Margie Peterson were really involved in the publications and were hands-on people. And Dick introduced me to them right away. They took a liking to me. As far as I'm concerned, they were my second parents. They just really, and the next thing I know, as a advertising salesman in Southern California, we had seven different offices around the U.S. And, you know, you only handled a territory in your division, which was Southern California. And Dick and I got along as the publisher, and I was the advertising salesman. I just took to it. It was just fantastic. Here I was meeting Edelbrock, Offenhauser, Escanderin, Moon, Weber, Schieffer, all the names in the automotive field, you know, and going to the drags, because Carcraft was a drag racing magazine. At that time, you know, there was Orange County. There was, 10, 15 drag strips in Southern California. I'd go to the drags every weekend that we were there, then the Nationals. And I met all the different manufacturers and everything. And I really brought up the ad sales for Carcraft. Hot Rod was the flagship in Ting magazine for Peterson. But Hot Rod, the salesmen were, you know, they were just, I call them transit. People would call them to get an ad. You didn't have to go sell them. Carcraft, you had to go sell an ad. So I really got involved with editorial, because I'd bring an editor with me, and we'd say, look, God, this is a great widget that the guy was building in his garage. And we said, we could do a story on this, but we need an ad. Now, that was not the way you're supposed to sell ads, but that's what we did.
Okay. It's funny how that's worked for the rest of that time forward now. Yeah. Advertorial is kind of how it happens these
exactly
days.
Exactly right. Yeah. Well, we're ahead of the game there. So from there, I did such a great job. Peterson brought me up to the
big league.
You at Hot Rod Magazine. Yeah. And when that happened, for some reason, it was a little tough on some of the other salesmen, because they were saying, why are you getting to do these things and go to the auto show in Detroit, you know, or New York? Because they weren't. They're just stay in their own territory. And that way I was introduced to the manufacturers in Detroit, the automobile manufacturers, Penske, DeLorean, Hurst, Shifters. And I was in that circle as an ad salesman because of Dick Day. And Dick Day then became the publisher of Hot Rod. And so I worked directly with him and Mr. Peterson. And Peter was just great with me. They were super people. And they'd bring me along to social events and stuff like that. Then all of a sudden I became the publisher of Carcraft, then the publisher of Hot Rod. And that opened my whole horizon. Because then Peterson's whole idea was entertainment. And being a publisher, I was really, I didn't do the articles. I had photographers, artists, editors, and things like that. I just was a front guy, so to speak, entertaining, taking potential sponsors because they'd buy ads, and an ad in Hot Rod was expensive, you know. And so I traveled basically the world, you know, to going to the manufacturers in Europe, to going to all the manufacturers in the United States, seeing how cars were built, seeing how carburetors were, everything like that. But it was an incredible opportunity. During that, and plus, I was on the weekends when they'd have a drags here and they're over, like Perdone and Landy and McEwen and Sox and Martin would ride dirt bikes on the weekend together. So I got into the dirt bike situation and met some people in the motorcycle industry besides the ones I'd meet in the advertising sales. During that time, we did a couple articles on Mickey Thompson, on his manifolds and his wheel company and his tires. And I met Mickey myself personally at that time. And I wouldn't say we became friends, but you know, we were socially, I'd see him at the drags, I'd see him at Bonneville, I'd see him at India, I'd see him at Daytona, and would always say hello and stuff like that. And then I hired a lady, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I believe you said you were like oil and water.
Well,
the two of you. And before we get any further on Mickey Thompson, I'm just going to say, let's take a quick break right now. Let my listeners take a deep breath before we're back with Sal Fish. Here at Slow Baja, we can't wait to drive our old Land Cruiser south of the border. And when we go, we'll be going with Baja Bound Insurance. Their website's fast and easy to use. Check them out at BajaBound.com. That's BajaBound.com, serving Mexico travelers since 1994. Hey folks, you know I'm always telling you, ask your doctor if Baja is right for you. Well, I don't know what your doctor's going to say, but I want to let you know right now, it's the open enrollment period for the 2023 Baja XL Rally. That's right. If you need a little Baja care, you got to get in right now during the open enrollment period for the 2023 Baja XL Rally. February 17th through 26th, it's 3,000 miles in 10 days. It's a minimal assistance rally. That means there's no rescue trucks or no medical helicopters or no travel guides. You get to rely on your own wits and resources and probably the other 150 or 180 vehicles that are in this rally with you, who are always darn nice and willing to tow you out or give you a ride to the auto parts store or to the mechanic or whatever you need. But hey, the Baja XL is open to anyone by anything. So if it's street legal, you can drive at their classes. There's a competition class. If you want to get in and solve geotagging treasure hunt questions all day and all night, there's the 4x4 touring class that Slow Baja does, where we just pull out our benchmark map first thing in the morning, get some machaca, some eggs, some hot coffee, take a look at where the route ends that day and figure out what the most scenic squiggly dirt roads are on our map, and that's how we do it. Again, there's no judging. It's a heck of a lot of fun. It's a major league adventure, and it will certainly cure your symptoms of mild seasonal lack of adventuring. All right, ask your doctor if Baja is right for you. The Baja XL Rally. More info at bajaxl.org, or feel free to DM me through slowbaja.com or the Slow Baja Instagram or Facebook sites for more info. All right, well, we're back with Sal Fish. We're sitting in his pad here in Malibu. It's a beautiful day, and we're talking about Sal meeting Mickey Thompson, the legend Mickey Thompson. Now, he's raced everything.
That's right. At that time, he was not only a legend, he was just a unique individual. I mean, he was a very, you know, most of the people that I met in the automobile industry, really, well, first of all, think about it back then. We're talking about, you know, in the mid-60s, okay? And Southern California was a hotbed of what was going on. And, I mean, you had Strop, and, I mean, just, I can't even begin to tell you all the names of the people that were, and I knew them all. Because, you know, being at Hot Rod Magazine, they were all friends of mine. And it was just exciting as can be to be in that thing. And I became, you know, just, I mean, I loved racing. I loved the whole thing, you know. I was not a racer per se because I didn't grow up that way. I was not a mechanic, really. But yet I was in the heart of what was going on. You know, I couldn't have, it was just exciting as can be. And it was a lot of work, though. There was no question about it. You know, I mean, I loved it because I didn't see it as a job. It was just exciting as can be, meeting these people that are on, you know, racing on the weekends or in the newspaper. And here I'm going to lunch with them or dinner, or I'm shaking hands at the start line at Indy with them. So I met racers, I met the manufacturers, I met sponsors, the people at BF Goodrich, all the tire companies. Anything to do with the automotive industry, and, you know, sponsors that were buying ads in that marketplace, you know, that were not automotive orientated but had something to sell, you know, Wrangler jeans or Levi's or a liquor or whatever that would entice that age group. And so, and then I met all the heads of the different advertising agencies in Detroit and Los Angeles. Became very good friends with them because, you know, we were putting presentations together with them, and they were buying into stuff. And hey, it was just breed love. The people were unbelievable that I met, and we just became really, really good friends. It wasn't just a business thing, it was a friendship thing.
And Mickey Thompson was like a super entrepreneur.
Mickey,
not only was he a highly qualified racer, setting speed records, Mexican road race, all that stuff, but also figuring out what's the angle, how do I make some money on this, what's the business. And so what happens when you two meet?
Well, that was something I picked up on Mickey right away. He wasn't just a driver. He was an over-the-top thinker and engineer, and he was a hands-on guy. He knew things that, you know, shocks, suspension, carburation, the things that he did were so far in advance, but he was you mentioned earlier the difference between Sal Fish and Mickey Thompson was like oil and water.
But those were your words.
You brought it back up. But I'm not saying that in a negative way. He was a street fighter. He was born in the streets. He grew up in the streets. And he was so out of place in my mind, his personality, because he was a rough guy. And when you'd go with the people at the automotive industry in Detroit, these were, you know, graduates from universities, they were engineers, and Mickey was just a hands-on, get-it-done guy. No finesse, just, this is the way we could do it. I could build a car with four engines in it and set a record, you know, and they'd look at him like, who's this guy? What do you mean? How are you going to do this? But his personality, he was so intense on his delivery to someone that he just sold you. He outbeat you by convincing you that what he was going to do for your product or whatever would revolutionize it. So he wasn't just a race car driver. Plus, he would start one thing and get someone to come in and run it and jump to another. He would never did just one thing. While he's building his wheel industry, he's building a manifold industry. He's building an exhaust industry. He's building a tire company. He's building this. He's building that. Just incredible guy. I mean, really, he was never stopped. Guy never slept. He was a workaholic and just really a unique guy. So we're meeting each other off and on, and I'm just strange feeling about the guy. You know, he's not the classiest guy I've ever met in my life, but I loved him. You know, he's just a cool guy. without even knowing it, I hire this young lady as my secretary at Hot Rod. Next thing I know, and she's a very class lady, name was Trudy, New York lady, classy as can be, beautiful, and come to work always. Her hair was immaculate, her makeup was immaculate, dressed unbelievable, brilliant, smart as can be, as classy as anyone I've ever met. She meets Mickey Thompson, and they fall in love. You talk about oil and water. It is the absolute...
Wow. Opposites.
Opposites of every... And when she told me she was started dating Mickey Thompson, I said, wait a minute. You're kidding me. I couldn't believe it. I said, this is... And next thing I know, she leaves me as a secretary and goes and starts working for Mickey Thompson. And they get married. And, you know, that's a totally different story. But... she was the greatest thing in the world that could have happened to Mickey, and he was the greatest thing that could happen to Trudy. They were, I mean, I've never seen a couple that were so meant for each other, but were so opposite, but that complemented each other. She was so dedicated to him, and whatever he did, and he was tough. I mean, he was a real tough guy to be around all the time, and he demanded... there was never enough. I don't care if there was 24 hours a day, he would somehow get another half an hour out of that day. And he expected everyone else that was associated with him to be the same way. So, now I'm at Hot Rod Magazine. This is when model car kits, Ravel and Mattel and there were other cars, were big deals. People were building model airplanes and cars and stuff. And I heard about the Ravel company that was on Marina Del Rey, and they were in Marina Del Rey, it was husband and wife, the Glassers. They were building a model car Bug, they called it the Baja Bug, that they were going to race in the Nora race, and we had covered the Nora race at Hot Rod.
So let's focus on this for a second here, Sal. 1967, we'll go back a little bit. So the Eakins and Robertson, they do a little speed run down to Tijuana to La Paz, create some buzz about that on motorcycles. And then a florist from Tarzana, whose delivery boy has blown up the motor in his Land Cruiser, he drops a V8 in his Land Cruiser and says, well, I think I can beat that record, which he doesn't do it. But on the run, he thinks, I think we've got the makings of a race. And then Bruce Meyer gets his Myers Manx down there and figures out how to load the thing up with gasoline so he doesn't have to stop, runs south, right. You know, does his mapping. So he gets the approach. He figures out the Bill Strop angle on this thing. How do I figure out how to beat this sucker? And he loads his Manx up with gas and all the extra tanks and everything, a rocket ship, and sets the record from La Paz back. And that sets the scene in summer of 67 for the first off-road race at Halloween, Day of the Dead, for 67, which you covered as a journalist.
That's correct. That's right. And, you know, Bruce Meyer, I had met him when he built his first, we did a story on Carcraft, when he first pulled his mold out for the Myers Manx. And so I knew him very well, you know, at that time.
Were you at God's right hand when he created the universe too? sounds like you were at the right hand of how all this stuff came together.
Well, I was there at the right time. And
exactly.
I was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and going, making calls to different places all around Southern California. And, you know, it was just a wild time. But so we go down to Ravel's thing, and I admire them. They've got this real Baja Bug that is just beautiful because the graphics were on it. Were gorgeous, just fantastic. And they had already run a Baja event, a rally, they called it at that time, with Nora. And it was in there. They made the model car kits that they were selling. And so I said, well, you know, we'd like to do an article on it. And they said, oh, great. And then before... we went to lunch, and before the day was over, they said to me, hey, you know what? The Baja 1000 is coming up. Would you like to race this car in the Baja 1000?
And this is the 68 event.
Yeah, 68. And I said, I mean, you'd let me race? And they said, yeah, if you want to do it, because they figured they'd get a bigger article in the magazine. And so, lo and behold, you know, I had said we'd do it. And one of my ad salesmen at Hot Rod was Bob Wagelin. And he was a pretty good mechanic. He was an SCCA driver. And so I said, hey, Bob, you want to race with me in Baja, in this Baja race? And he goes, I'd love to. And I said, well, you're going to have to work on the car then. You know, we could keep it at your house, and let's do what we have to do to get it Baja ready to go. Well, neither one of us knew anything about the Baja race, other than what we knew, you know, because of the magazines and stuff. But I was not a racer. I rode motorcycles with a lot of great racers, but I was not a racer. You know, I was too busy doing what I was doing at Peterson. So we didn't have any idea about pre-running. We were really cherries, I'm telling you. And to be honest with you.
It's a polite way of putting it, yeah. Ignorance was bliss.
To be honest with you, I had this vision of the Baja Peninsula. I thought there was probably a yellow line going down there that you'd follow the race course. And there was these places called like Rancho Chapala, which I envisioned this gorgeous, because I'd seen movies of Mexico and, you know, the senoritas with the flower dresses and the guys with the bandoleras across their chest and drinking tequila and the guy with the big sombrero and everybody just whooping up and guitar players. And I assumed that's what Rancho Chapala would be like, one of our checkpoints. In fact, at that time, it was kind of I think there was three or four checkpoints, but then you could go any place you could figure out how to get down to La Paz from Ensenada at the time. And I was just so jazzed about going to go down to Mexico and be in this event. And, you know, I had to take a little time off, and which I didn't have any problem with Peterson, because I was my own boss, to be honest with you. And we were going to try to figure out what we got to get down to Ensenada, and we were going to tow it, supposedly, but we didn't have a tow vehicle or anything. And I said, wait a minute, we're going to drive 1,000 miles. Don't you think
on dirt?
Well, I didn't realize it was all dirt. I said, we ought to figure out if we could drive it from our house in Malibu here to Ensenada. Let's see if we could even get it to there. So we drove the car. It was street legal. We drove it from Malibu to Ensenada. And I met at that time, you talk about how I was able to do things. I met some of the greatest people in Ensenada. Somehow, I don't know how, why it happened, but I met, you know, Nico Saad, who was at that point in time and is the owner of San Nicolas Hotel. Carlo Vetta, who is the owner of the Bahia. These were all guys we're about the same age, really, all of them. They were like second generation. Their parents were the ones that had started these places, and they were taking them. And they were all educated in the United States, spoke perfect English, very nice people. Pepe Rendon, who was the owner, his family, of the El Rey Sol, his wife, Lupita's mother, was the one that had the El Rey Sol restaurant, the finest restaurant, French restaurant, almost in the United States, and here it was sitting in Mexico. So I met everybody, the owner of Husson family, all of those people, and Pepe Rendon, or Limon rather, who became a very good friend of mine, whose wife was the daughter of the largest Ford dealership in Mexicali, and very close to the governor at that time, Milton Castellano, and the mayors that were down in Ensenada and Mexicali. And so he became a very good friend of mine. So we entered the first race. We hit a rock in Colnett.
Hang on for a second, Sal. Let's just talk about, I think of those early days, and I asked Mary McGee about this when I talked to her recently. I said, was it a happening or was it a race? And she said, well, I certainly thought it was a race in 67, but in reflection, it was also a happening. Now, you guys, in my opinion, there was no history. You know, the 67 thing had happened, but that was just people in cars driving on dirt and trying to get to the finish. Now, 68, people are going to try and go faster. And tell me a little bit about What was inside your car? What did you bring? How did you prepare? In my opinion, you're driving to the moon.
Yeah, well, very good point, Michael, really. You know, the map that Nora provided you was the best thing there was. I mean, but it wasn't a map. I mean, it was just, you go Ensenada and you go down this road here, X number of miles, and then there was a checkpoint, then you got to here, it calls Rancho San Inez, and there was a lady there, and then you'd get to Rancho Chapala, which is, this is my highlight, thinking we were going to have margaritas.
Dancing
and,
girls.
Yeah, and dancing.
Mariachis.
Yeah. Anyway, and there were the guys that actually went down there and pre-ran, and were like Mickey Thompson, which I didn't realize this until I saw him in the motel, because we were staying at the same motel. But there was a book that I have at home, and it was a bush pilot guys that they flew a route and had one of the best books at the time of illustrations and different spots where the marble mine was, where the whales were, where, I mean, really, this is, Baja was primitive. I mean, there was one paved road, and the rest was all graded, and they were the roads, basically, that Cortez and the Franciscan fathers marched up to, you know, harkening conquer Baja.
Yeah, harkening back to your Jesuit days, but you weren't on a donkey.
that's exactly right. These are those trails.
El Camino Real, yeah.
Yeah. It was a very unique time. So we were so naive, and I got to regress a little, you know, because of my dad, you know, being a mechanic and stuff, he was dedicated to that garage. It opened up at 5:30 in the morning, and if at 6 o'clock, 6:30 when he closed, if someone called and had a dead battery, he would open the door, go start the car. He was just a beautiful man, nicest guy in the world, but he would give no matter what. And that was a conflict at home sometimes, because he's supposed to be home for dinner, and, you know, he'd be an hour late, but he was making money for the family. And my mom and dad, their whole life was dedicated to us boys. You know, they wanted the best for us. And the only reason I'm saying that is just, it was his personality. It was just, I'd never heard a bad word out of my mom's mouth or my dad's mouth. They were just great people, and he always had a smile on his face. And he used to say, you know, you have to work at being a bad person and being mean, but it's easy to smile and be a nice person to everybody. His whole idea was that. And, you know, he would fix a car, and, you know, that was the problem. Then the person would say, well, you know, it doesn't, he would, if it was a 15 cent part, that's what you got charged for. You didn't get 16 cents or 20 cents. He's a very honest and very straightforward guy. And I think that, I think, rubbed off on all us boys a little, and I admired his personality that way. So I think that helped me in Baja, you know, because everybody I met, we gravitated to, shook hands, and abrazo, a good embrace, and I fell in love with Baja, okay? So here we're going to do this event. Bob Wagon, who was my ad salesman, who I really didn't, I knew, you know, a lot, and I knew his wife and stuff, but I'd never seen him out socially that much or anything, and I didn't know how he felt about Mexico, he was a chain smoker. I didn't smoke or anything, and at some point we're going to get back to
68 and your trip to the dancing girls.
Yeah, in San Francisco at Haight Ashbury and the drug situation that was just blew my mind. But anyway, we're in Ensenada.
So you've driven this. You've driven this model based. It's a car that's going to have models built of it, and you're getting this gift bestowed on you because you're the publisher of the magazine,
right.
And they're hoping to get more advertorial coverage, editorial coverage. Some they'll put an ad in for sure, but they're going to get all the free editorial. And you've tested this thing by stuffing it full of probably everything you had to live on for ever, and a jacket and a sleeping bag or whatever you brought, to bottle of tequila, I hope. And your test run, your whole test run preparation was driving it from Malibu to Ensenada.
That was it. And you're right. You know, the compared to how the vehicles are built today, and they have been built, you know, the idea of how you beat the Baja back then was you had a tank, a heavily armored vehicle, as opposed to
lightweight now.
Lightweight now, yeah. Suspension. So here we had this Baja Bug that I don't know what it weighed, but if we could have fit another engine and transmission in the back, we would have done it, thinking that's what you're supposed to take.
But exactly, the opposite.
Exactly. You don't wear underwear, you know, today, you know, you don't want to. But we had at that time, you had space blankets, you know, that was because the moon.
Yeah.
You had this little tinfoil space blanket.
This is a year before man walked on the moon, folks.
Yes.
So the moon shot and the effort to get to the moon was rather large in the culture. Kids at school were eating things that astronauts eat, these terrible little pasty things. Yeah.
That's what we took, because we figured, well, if we, you know, have to eat on the road or whatever, we had no clue. You know, we had a space blanket, space food. I had my hot rod jacket. He had his hot rod sales jacket. We had, I think, between the two of us, I think maybe we had, I don't know if we had $200 in cash, and he thought that was going to, if we had a real problem, we'd be able to get our way out of it with the money. We had, I think we had an extra set of shocks. We had a couple of things of oil. I mean, we had, but it was jammed. You know, Baja Bug then was, it was real tight in there.
Yeah, there's no room for you two, let alone all that stuff.
It was very tight, okay? So, we're in the hotel in Ensenada, two nights before the race. And I'm walking to my room. Bob and I were sharing a room there. And there's a lot of noise coming out of this room about three doors down before we got to our door. And the door's wide open. And there's just 25 guys in this room. And I look in, and all the wall, the rooms were big, but the walls inside had these sheets of paper scotch taped to. And lo and behold, there was Mickey Thompson, big as life, in there. And he looked like hell. I mean, he was dirty. He had bib overalls on, and he had looked like he hadn't slept for a week, and it looked like he'd been working on a car for a month, and he had grease on him. And Danny Thompson, his son, was there, and Bill House, who was his head mechanic, was there, and they had all these guys in there. And he looked and he saw me at the door, and he says, come on in, Sal. He says, let me show you, have you looked at the map yet? And I go, yeah, I've got the map. I had this one page.
Yeah, the Nora thing was like a kid's drawing. It was a kid's drawing of Mexico.
What do you mean? Haven't you gone on a pre-run? And I said, pre-run, no. And he goes, oh, well, then you got to look at this. Well, Mickey had been down there for like 4 weeks in a row. He had flown it, and he and his son had driven it. And they had detail, which I could never to this day still, dead cow, turn right. And I'm going, well, that cow's not going to still be there. It's going to be eaten, or how's he going to know where to go? But he had it go 110 miles an hour. And I'm going, 110 miles an hour? Our car won't even go 40 miles an hour on the highway. You know, what's this guy doing? And he had the most meticulous, like, rally notes, which are not then involved in off-roading. It was rally guys did that. But because of his experience in Pan Am, American Road Race,
exactly,
and stuff like that, and he brought his knowledge from all the other events that he had been in, and they had a detailed, and he handmade this roller cylinder that looked like if you were to have a roll of toilet paper, but, you know, it was wider, that you'd wrap this thing, and his co-rider would be
cranking the notes.
Yeah, telling him 50 yards, turn right, look for cactus that looks like an elephant, turn left. And they had 1,000 miles. And believe me, that just took the air out of both Bob Wiggett and mine. We said, what are we doing? We're not in the same event. This guy is in, are we? And it was kind of earth-shattering. But, you know, we said we went to Husson's. This is when you get smashed before you got in your race car.
Forget about it.
And we had a great time. We're going to get to La Paz, the heck with it, you know. One way or the other, we're going to get there. So bottom line is, that was a real introduction, again, to Mickey's way of doing things. And to a lot of other guys who were very serious about it. But this was an adventure for me. I wasn't going to become a race driver. I was going to do something. I certainly wasn't going to get in a blown fuel dragster or a funny car or an Indy car, although I did get a ride in a NASCAR, you know, with trying to remember who it was back at Daytona gave me a ride, not in the race, but around the track. But
let's say Fireball Roberts. Just to pick a name, Curtis Turner.
You know what? It was almost like Fireball, believe it or not. Gave me a ride.
Herschel McGriff.
And this is, you know, I knew Bill France Jr. You know, it was just a lot of fun. So anyway, we entered the race. We broke. But I was, you talk about being hooked. This was all I could think about was, first of all, Baja, Mexico, and wanting to finish the Baja 1000 event. You know?
Well, I'm not going to let you off the hook here, Sal. I will let you catch your breath, but you and Bill are out there driving along. You know, it gets dark. You break the transmission. You have no idea where you are. It's inky black. And you hear a car coming along. And you think you're pretty close to Rancho Chapala and the dancing girls. And the margaritas. So it's probably playing some tricks on your mind at this. I'm assuming you're a little exhausted anyways. But you hear a vehicle coming along, and you manage to get it to stop. Pick up the story.
Well, we'd been running, but we knew we were kind of be almost next to last because cars were passing us, you know. But there were, you know, it was a pretty good entry field. But back then also, you know, there wasn't – guys were going all over the place, finding their own route and everything. But we figured we were pretty close to Rancho Chapala, just mileage-wise and everything. And we were already, God, I think we had been in the race at least, because we started early in the morning. It was late at night. So we had been running. We should have been past Rancho Chapala, but I knew we weren't there because I didn't see the dancing girls or anything else, you know, or the guys giving me margaritas and everything. And, you know, anyway, we break. And it was back then, Baja was dead silence. There was no, you could hear the wings on bees and birds and the bells on the cows around their neck, but you couldn't see them, you know, it was so quiet.
And so dark.
And so dark and cold.
Yeah.
So we're standing next to this broken VW off of the trail that we were on, absolutely had no clue exactly where we were and how. What were we going to do? How did we get? Because we had no chase vehicle. We didn't have our wives didn't even know where we really were going because we weren't sure. We said, La Paz, it's south, you know, down there. When we get there, we'll call you and blah, blah. And there was no phones. There was nothing like that, satellites or anything like that. So we were standing there and kind of arguing with each other. And Bob was just smoking like crazy, chain smoking. And I don't smoke. And it was driving me nuts, that smoke blowing on me. And, we didn't have a plan. We said, well, someone's going to come by. And we also said, well, the checkpoint must be ahead of us a little ways, and we'll get there, and they'll help us. Next thing I know, we could hear this shifting coming from, I mean, it seemed like 100 miles away. It was so quiet, and you'd hear this thing. All of a sudden, I stand right in the middle of what I thought was a track, because I don't want this guy to go around me. I want whoever it's coming to stop. Car comes flying in, almost hits me, pulls to a stop. Guy yells out of the car, hey, have you seen Garner? And I'm looking at, wait a minute. I said, wait a minute, no. James Garner? And I said, no, we haven't seen him. He says, well, we're his chase vehicle. He must be ahead of you. And I said, yeah, he probably is. And he starts to take off. I said, wait a minute. I almost laid down in front of the car. I said, stop. Wagon goes to the other side, passenger side, and says, we had our tow rope out by now, which was a short tow thing. It was about 8 feet long. He says, can you take us to Chapala? And he goes, okay. No one got out of the car. They wanted to go get Garner. That's where they had to be, wherever he was. So we tie the tow rope to the front of their chase vehicle, back of our VW. I get in as the driver. Bob's a co-rider. Next thing I know, the guy just pulls off. I mean, just going, I've got my foot. Now, I'm looking at his brake lights. I'm looking at his brake lights, right? Or his running lights, night brake, because he didn't never put his brakes on. I've got my foot slammed down on the brake. I'm like an anchor. He's just dragging us. I'm wondering, we're going to get killed. He's going to stop. I'm going to run into the back of his vehicle, and it's all over. Next thing I know, he stops the vehicle, right? And it seemed like, at the most, 20 minutes we'd been being pulled.
20 hair-raising minutes.
Yeah, 20, I mean, really.
Hair-raising.
We went faster being towed than we went at any time during the race behind this guy with my foot on the brake. And I was just, I think I broke the steering wheel. My hands were just crushing the wheel. I was so frightened. He stops the car. There's nothing around us. He stops the car.
And it's still night. Out. It's still dark.
Oh, pitch dark. Jumps out. Does his end of the toe strap, and I'm out of the car, and I said, where are you going? He says, this is Rancho Chapala. See ya. And I go, wait a minute. Where's the margaritas and the dancing girls and the guacamole? You know, all these things that I heard about Mexico and everything. And he's gone. And we're standing there in the middle of the desert. It's very early, dark in the morning, cold as hell. I got my hot rod jacket on. Wagon's got his jacket on. And we're sad. I said, well, there must be, you know, dancing girls. There must be a saloon. There must be a motel here. There must be everything here because it's Rancho Chapala.
It's on the map.
And we're standing there.
It's a checkpoint.
Nothing. Nothing. There's no one. We saw no one. No one said anything or anything like that. It starts to get light. And I'm going, now this is when Rancho Chapala was in the middle of the dry lake bed there. There was no highway there. It was right there. And next thing I know, I see a cracked out, like, old wood lean-to and a tarp. And all of a sudden, a couple of weird-looking guys walking around this and a bunch of trash all over the place. And a plane lands, and I go, wait a minute. So I didn't go to the weird-looking guys. I ran over to where this little single-seat plane lands, and it's part of the Nora group, and they were just doing something about closing up the checkpoint, which wasn't there. They had already closed because it was time to, you know, to move to the next point. And so I asked them, I said, well, what do we do? How do we get out of here? And they said, oh, people will be coming along the race course. They'll get you. Now, I mean, I'm really frightened, to be honest. I'm saying, no one knows really where we are. They don't care where we are, you know, in the organization. Our wives don't know where we are, how far we're on the race course. We have no idea where we are, except it says Rancho Chapala. How, and we do have enough intelligence to say, you know what? We better not go south because it's still a ways to get to La Paz. We need to figure out how to get back to Ensenada because we knew it was only a couple of hundred miles, whatever it was at the time. Bottom line, now it's light. Those three or four Mexican guys that we saw that I didn't realize what they were, you know, they were living in the middle of this heap of junk out there, which I couldn't believe. I thought, you know, I said, my God, this is... And there were certainly no women there, I'll tell you that right now. Next thing I know, again, we hear, and I think I'm hallucinating, we hear this vehicle shifting down, coming towards us from the south, from the La Paz area. And we're just kind of blown away because we hadn't heard anyone since Garner left us off.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking, we're standing there in the front of our bug now, and next thing I know, here's this vehicle, which was like a Pismo Beach. That was the kind of wood, rail job, all open, nothing, just a guy that looked like the Abominable Snowman or something, completely covered in the Chapala white dust, completely covered. He had goggles on, shorts, a tank top. Just looked, I mean, I'm looking at this guy coming right at me. He stops and he goes, which way is La Paz? And I'm going, wait a minute, am I hallucinating? What in the hell is going on here? And I go,
It's that way. And Wagon just almost breaks my hand. He says, wait a minute, don't tell him. We got to talk to this guy. You know, so he grabs the guy, grabs him by the... Wagon's starting to get a little freaky. He grabs the guy by the shoulder and says, hey, wait a minute, don't leave, don't leave. And he goes, well, I'm going to La Paz. And he said, well, you're going the wrong way. This is Ensenada. But he says, can you give us a hand? You know, can you tow us somewhere? He says, no, I've got to get to La Paz.
This is a racer.
No, it wasn't. It was a guy that, I don't know if he was in, it wasn't a racer. It was just a guy out there that was either wanted to go down to La Paz or part of this race thing. Or he just flips off us, turns around, and leaves. Now we're standing there again going, what in the hell are we doing? Bottom line is, I finally have the balls, to put it bluntly, to walk over to where this piece of crap shed is and try to communicate with these two guys. And now I see there's about a half a dozen of them.
And they haven't paid you any attention at all?
No. They're just, I mean, they didn't even come over to say hello to us. They're walking around doing, I don't know what they're doing out there. So I go over in my beautiful Spanish, which is, you know, buenos dias, buenas tardes, donde está baña, you know, and that was it. And so I'm trying to explain to the guy, anybody, do you have a car? And I didn't see any cars, no truck. And I'm wondering, how do these guys live out here and everything? And I still to this day don't understand how I got this related. The guy explains to me that there is a truck that comes every couple of days with turtles in it from the La Paz area, the south.
These are sea turtles for food, folks. Back in the day, that used to be a staple of the diet there.
Exactly,
so
right.
So a truck, a steak bed truck, I'm assuming, stacked full of sea turtles.
Sea turtles, okay.
Every couple days.
Yeah, every couple days. This is my interpretation of it, okay? So now I'm feeling, wow, this is good. We're on the couple of days.
You got
thing.
That to look forward to.
Yeah, we could have this guy, if we have to leave our vehicle, which I wasn't about to do, because first of all, I was embarrassed that we broke
it's not yours either.
The vehicle. Exactly right. How am I going to explain this and everything? We've got to get it back. So one of us is going to stay here. I've already got it planned out. I was going to stay because I knew Wagling couldn't handle being there by himself. I'd let him go with the guy and somehow would get a vehicle and come back here. And
you'd live off space food.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot left, let me tell you. Anyway, but that was a little, I wasn't even thinking. And, you know, got to remember now, I was not a Boy Scout. I never went on camping trips. I never slept in a sleeping bag. I didn't know how to put a tent and a snake. I hated snakes. You know, I wasn't an outdoors guy, you know, okay? So now I'm in the outdoors, okay? And I'm saying, don't worry, Wagon, this truck's going to come and blah, blah, blah. Well, it was, seriously, we'd been there, let's say, after midnight. Now it was light. It had to be about 5:30 in the morning, whatever it was. We're walking around kicking the thing. He's worried about he's going to run out of cigarettes. Forget about food and water, what I was thinking about. He's more concerned about cigarettes. Anyway, it's mid-afternoon. Nothing's happening, you know. And I'm saying, God, maybe I miss him at 20 days. I don't know what the hell he was saying. And lo and behold, coming, you could hear him coming for an hour, you know. A truck pulls up, steak bed. There's a dog in the front. It's just a bench seat. There's a driver, real Mexican looking guy, a dog sitting next to him, and a kid, about a 10-year-old kid or something. They stop right at the rancho there. They talk to the people that are there. I'm standing right there with them, you know, going, because I'm not letting this guy go or anything. And I'm trying to explain to him, I want him, my first idea was, we will pay him, because we had, I think it was $200-something, we'd give him everything in our car, you know, if he will unload the turtles, and we could put the Volkswagen in the bed, and the kid and the dog could get in the back, and, you know, stand with the car, and Wagling and I would sit with this guy, and we'd go to Ensenada. Well, I don't know how this happened. We unload the turtles.
And these are big things.
They're big turtles.
You can.
I'm still not sure they weren't alive, but I don't get what the hell is it, dried meat or what the hell the deal was or anything. But we unload the turtles, and now we've got a 3,000 pound or whatever it is, Volkswagen, that how are we going to get on the back of this? And I'm looking at this thing, and it's not a cool looking truck. Let me tell you, it's been turtled
out. A little rickety?
Rickety would be polite, okay? So this guy, I mean, you know, Mexican engineering is fantastic. He was looking around at the wash, there was a wash there and everything. He figured out that if he backed up, and it was like the sand wash, there was a berm, and if we all pushed the Volkswagen around this guy's little lean-to house and went up on those little hard-packed trail, we could almost be even with the back of the truck, which I would have never figured out in a lifetime. And we could push the vehicle on there.
Yeah, you're looking for ramps like anybody else would be.
Yeah, I figured.
Well, and there's no wood there.
Yeah, no, there's nothing there.
You got to disassemble a house.
So we get the Volkswagen on the stake bed, and now I realize that how are we going to hold it down in there? Well, we had our one tow strap, and secondly, that where was the kid and the dog going to be, because there was very little room.
You couldn't open the doors.
Yeah, couldn't open the doors, no. But even if you could, sitting in the back would have been frightening. I mean, anything. I figured, the guys would stand up, the kid would stand up, and the dog, maybe he could jump in the window of the deal, and he'd stand up next to the deal. Well, we gave him the $200, all our space crap food, everything we had in the car, and our jackets, and everything. And he says, okay, I'll do it. Very nice guy. He was really nice there. And I assumed, I said, okay. And I get around to the passenger side and have Wagon come with me to get in. And he goes, no. Get in the back. So Wagon was just furious. He was going to, that was it. So anyway, bottom line is we get in the back. The dog and the kid are in the front. And I didn't know this, but he couldn't start it because he didn't have an alternator.
You can't make this stuff up.
So we're sitting there now, but he knew he couldn't start it because every time he stopped, he had some kind of a belt pulley thing that he would
light it off
on the starter or something and get the thing, and it would start. And I'm going, wait a minute, this is crazy. So we get in the thing, okay? We leave. I think this is the greatest thing in the world. We're on our way to Ensenada.
You're moving in the right direction.
It's just, now this thing had no shocks on it. We're standing in the back, and we've gone, a quarter of a mile. And, I mean, I'm exhausted. I'm hanging on, inside Wagon. Dust is flowing on, hot as can be, dusty as can be. We go 5 miles. He keeps the thing running, but he's got the brake on, which is amazing he had a brake. There's nothing. I see nothing around here or anything like that. He gets out, and next thing I know, there's four or five people that show up that came out of, I don't know, they got out of a cactus, which I learned that's the way things happen in Mexico. You think you're alone, and there's people all over. They come out of anthill graves. I don't know where the hell they live, but they come out. And after the sixth time he does this, I realize he's almost like the postman.
Yeah, you're on the Pony Express. There's not much express.
He stops at all these little places and tells them that their brother-in-law sent that everything's fine, but Chiquita died or so-and-so. And he was the town crier from La Paz all the way to Ensenada, besides delivering the turtles. Well, you could imagine. I knew that road going from Rancho Chapala back to Ensenada like the back of my hand. I saw every rock, every bump, every cactus going the wrong way, backwards on it and everything. It was, I think it was 2 days and a night that we got back to Ensenada. It was the most unique, crazy experience I've ever. Now, why Bob and I would even consider doing this again is kind of tell you what kind of brains we have. We were so excited about the adventure. And I said, man, Bob, we are going to prepare.
We're going to conquer it this time.
This was incredible. You know,
yeah,
it really was. But that's just, you know, seriously, Michael, one of a million experience. And I learned so much about the Hispanic people on that return trip. They are the most gracious, have nothing, but whatever they had, it was ours when we stopped there. And they, because he was telling him in Spanish, I realized how crazy gringos were down there, and they were sitting in Chapala not knowing what to do, and he was telling his story of it, and they were laughing and looking at us, and kids were coming around wanting to touch us. It was, and I had, oh, the other thing that was more important than anything we gave them, I had Car Craft and Hot Rod decals, and you'd think I was giving them $100 bills. What they were going to do with them, I had no idea, but I was handing those out like it was the end of the world. They just loved it.
Well, it's amazing to me, Sal, we've talked for well over an hour now, and we haven't even gotten to 1969. So I might have to make this into a two-part run. But I just want to say, hey, it's really been a delight to spend a little time in your presence and get these amazing stories. And I sincerely hope we get a chance to do this real, real soon.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate having the opportunity. And I hope that you will be able to make a lot of sense of this thing, and I hope that your listeners will enjoy it.
Well, the amazing thing, too, is funny, you went on to own this racing thing. From that start to coming back for 69, you did finish, right? You eventually finished one of these races.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
And then by 73, you and Mickey were thinking about partners. We could run this thing, and that was his brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And then you said oil and water, and then 74, and somehow an explosion happened after that, and it became the thing that it is, trophy trucks and craziness. Yeah. And 50 plus years later, and you're still smiling.
Well, you know, again, you know, there was no college or school with off-road promoter 101. You know, everything we were doing, we had to do maybe more than 10 times because it was no one else had done it. And you know, having Mickey and Trudy, you know, as the incentive and the drive is what gave me the will that something can happen here. And Mickey convinced me, you know, that I should leave Hot Rod, the greatest, unbelievable job in the world, you know, with the publisher of the number one automotive magazine at that time.
Yeah, you should leave that cushy first-class life that you've been living to go live in the dirt in Baja, stapling millions of staples along 1,000 miles.
That's a story all in itself. I wish I own the staple company, as many staples and steaks, which people thought I was going to Baja and eating steaks. But no, there were wood steaks that we'd pound into the ground. But anyway, I know we're going to cut this one short. Great opportunity to share some of my life with your listeners, which I feel that the experience is still one that is available in Mexico, in Baja and Baja Sur. The people are just as gracious as can be. It's still a beautiful country. There's still a lot to see there. And I think what Ed Perlman is doing, you know, what he did and his son Mike has started doing with the rally, Mexican rally, is fantastic. And what Roger Norman, the gentleman that bought Score International after I sold it, you know, to him 10 years ago, basically November of this year, he's brought a lot to the event that I wasn't able to do at that time because he's very into the social media and the high tech end of it, which, you know, I was still trying to figure out how to dial the telephone, let alone use a computer or what have you.
Well, I'm going to pay you a compliment because I just spent an afternoon with El Tomate, your old friend Ramon Castro in Ensenada, and he told me about how hands-on you were. Now, you're the owner of this thing. You're the boss. You're the jefe. But you're out there marking the 1,000-mile course relentlessly, day after day after day. And people only see you kissing babies and smiling and with the pretty girls at the start and finish. But there's a lot that went on behind the scenes that was not glamorous at all. And your beautiful wife, Barbara, you said that maybe the reason you've been able to be married for all these years is because you were on the road so often, you know, but it was not very glamorous a lot of the time.
Well, there's no question about it, but it really was, you know, and when you're bringing up some things that, you know, are way back in the back of my mind, you're triggering when you think about it. You know, we're talking about Baja, but, you know, we went from putting on 3 races to, I brought it to 8 one year, you know, to our Riverside, to Lucerne, Prim, Parker. You know, it wasn't just Baja. So I was dealing, not speaking Spanish, unfortunately, and I regret that a million times. I wish I had that talent, but I always figured I taught them how to speak English, you know, and we got along. You know, we'd be sitting on the dirt talking to an ejido, a rancho owner, and just going and pointing on you know, with the sand and trying to figure out how I could get from A to B. Did they know a way to go behind their rancho that I could connect? But in doing that, dealing with the Mexican officials, you know, let's face it, we were dealing with presidents, governors, mayors, the environmentalists. At the same time, I was having to go to the Bureau of Land Management and different agencies here in the United States to put on the races in Nevada and California and Buffalo, New York, and Canada. You know, we put races on there too. It wasn't just as much as I was involved, and I really still am involved in Baja. I love it, and the people. I mean, they're so gracious to me when I go down there. But we were also negotiating with the United States and all the people that were against what we were doing, because you had the environmentalists, which had no clue. We were the ones that were protecting the desert. It was the weekend warriors that were coming down, excuse me, and leaving their trash. The racer, the score racer, we left the place better than we found it. And you know, that was a hard sell. But and I look back and I go, how was I wearing all those hats? But it was because it was not a job. It was a passion. The racers were my family. Barbara and I have never had kids. And I to this day, you know, I have friends that raced with us in the early days. And the last race we put on that I see socially, that I see, it was hard to do when I was, you know, the owner of Score, because sure as heck I knew that I would socialize as one of these guys, and unfortunately there'd be a situation that I might have to disqualify him.
Well, you had to do that with Mickey Thompson, and, you know,
just
your
like
partner.
Sponsors. Yeah. I disqualified, quote, my partner twice, you know. And, you know, speaking of partners, as naive as I was when Mickey convinced me to leave Hot Rod because he was going to make me his partner and we were going to make this off-road as big as NASCAR. Well, when I actually looked at what I signed and the things I did, I didn't really realize that 49% of a company was not being a partner. But Mickey was always good enough, treated me as, you know, his partner. He was on me about everything, but I was very fortunate that he wanted to do what he wanted to do in the stadium racing. And he allowed me to buy him out, and thank God before he and Trudy, unfortunately, had the terrible situation. And, you know, it gave me the opportunity to be selfish and do really what I wanted to do at Score.
Yeah, and to kind of put a bow on it now, Sal, I think the interesting thing, obviously I'm involved with Nora and what Eliseo Garcia and Mike Perlman have done, that they're walking in their father's shoes. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing for me is to see the generational relationships that grandfathers are sharing these vehicles, and now maybe some are doing UTVs because they're so easy.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, an 80-year-old grandfather sharing a vehicle with his son, or Robbie Gordon sharing a vehicle with his son Max, and his son Max is driving. You know, Parnelli's son PJ is driving, and it's kind of neat to see it carrying on something that you started.
Well, you know, the thing, I think one, there was a lot of things that convinced me that the life I was living as publisher would change, and but it would change for the better. I think it's really, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I had the opportunity to go to all forms of motorsports. You know, I saw boat racing, drag racing, Formula One racing, SCCA racing, motorcycle racing, airplane racing, because we covered all those. You know, those were, it was exciting to be able to do that. But what I saw in the off-road community, it truly, as trite as this might sound, but you got to remember, we're talking about 52 years ago, okay? I really saw a family sport. These weren't all sponsored people. These were people that had a desire, an adventure. And I felt that I was the steward. I had to keep that flame going with SCORE. I wanted it to continue to be, and some people say, well, you had too many classes. Well, no, I didn't have too many classes. I had a class that if you only could spend $8,000 on a vehicle, you could go down there, and I treated that family or that individual that was in that vehicle the same way I treated, you know, an Ivan Stewart or a Parnelli Jones or whoever it was,
the firefighter from San Clemente was the same.
Pardon?
The firefighter from San Clemente was the same.
Yeah.
Or your friend Ramon Castro,
you know,
was the same.
They were my customer, and they were, no matter if they were a celebrity, which, you know, we've had some of the greatest celebrities in motorsports and in other forms of the movie industry, doctors, attorneys. They were, when they got in that race car, my biggest concern was that they got to the finish line and it was a safe event. When they put that helmet on and I shook their hand at the start or at the finish, they were my customer and I was responsible for them. And that's how I ran SCORE. Every one of those people, I might not remember their name if I saw them, you know, in the, because I saw a lot of people every race,
sure.
You know, but they were, I felt very responsible, and it was my, it wasn't a job, it was my passion. And that's why I enjoyed it so much. And that's why when you say, I used to love going out there, instead of being in an office, I was out there looking for a new trail or talking to a rancher and asking him, is it okay, can we go through your land? Or no, okay, how about another glass of tequila or a bottle of tequila? And we'd cut the deal. So I feel that I've been blessed, a very fortunate individual to do what it did. And I have to also, which we haven't even talked about, but you know, yeah, we're talking to Sal Fish, but you know, there were a lot of people that volunteered and that worked. We only had a very small payroll at SCORE, you know, but when you look at the people that really made SCORE what it is today, you know, my nephew Paul, the secretaries that came, and yeah, they made a salary, but not the kind of salary that they could have made working in a real, you know, business, so to speak. Because, you know, the only income we were getting was 50% of an entry and whatever sponsorship I could sell. And it was not easy, let me tell you, because there's a lot of things you had to spend money on, you know, to make a race.
And who would have thought that the thing would have really exploded once the manufacturers walked away from it?
Well,
that's the crazy part.
That really was the crazy part. You know, I came up with the idea with Frank D'Angelo of the SCORE Trophy truck, because I was getting this vibes from the manufacturers, and I was seeing that was the industry was, you know, just like at Indy supposedly and NASCAR, you know, the car that wins on Sunday is the one they drive on Monday.
Yeah, it
you
sells
know,
on
which
Monday
is a far cry today, but that was the truth. And here all of a sudden mini pickups in the pickup industry was becoming, you know, and the SUVs, you know, that's why the sponsors at Toyota for all those great years that sponsored us, because that vehicle, people would stop me on the street and say, you know, is that, you know, because it was all painted up with the SCORE logos there, do you drive the Baja on that? And they'd say, well, gee, my wife should be in that to take the kids to the soccer, you know, game. And so there was a lot of things going on at that time. But it just, to me, it was such an exciting time, such an exciting group of people. The sponsors that, you know, when you think of Toyota, it was almost 18 years with me as a sponsor. BFG still is a sponsor of SCORE. Takati Brewery, Bill Stein Shocks. These people invested maybe not a lot of money, but they helped me make SCORE what it is today. My nephew Paul Fish, Sue Johnson, you know, Bill Savage, Dominic Clark, Oscar Ramos, the Rodriguez family, Memo and Terry, their whole family would come down. Volunteers, Bill Wick. These are people that gave their time. They came down and got a t-shirt and something from me. You know, they came down on their own gas with their own vehicles and went out in the middle of nowhere. I'd tell them, this is where you go and you're going to stay there for 3 days. You know, hey, they loved it because where else, and I figured it out, would get 300 volunteers. Where else, what other form of motorsport could you have gone out to India and been a flagman or whatever and been, you're a major domo. You're in charge out there. You're out there by yourself, and you get to see these guys come through, and that's when it's so sophisticated today with the way they do things. But back in those days, you know, we took a beer can and put some silver tape around it, tied it to the car, and would get a roll of theater stubs, and that's what you stopped at a checkpoint, and it was a different color for each checkpoint, and that volunteer at SCORE would put that thing in the checkpoint.
In the can,
and at the end of the race, we'd cut it off and hopefully not find a finger in there, a quarter of a finger, because, you know, the guy took off while the guy's finger was in there, and would count the stuck stubs, and that's how you figured he went to every place. He didn't cheat. I mean, it was a different time back then.
Yeah.
Today, now, you know, with the satellite and the GPS and airplanes, helicopters, and everything, it's still exciting as can be, and I think they're doing a great job with it. But those are the things that made it, I think, what stimulated me and the drive that I had, and what Mickey taught me how to do things down there and learn the terrain and everything that kept me going.
Well, I'm glad that I finally got to the bottom of the turtle truck story, because the first time I heard the turtle truck story, it was Steve McQueen getting a ride back from Bahia de Los Angeles to Ensenada. So that's how, that's like, you know, telephone in kindergarten. That's how the story had gone around. It was actually Steve McQueen now. And he was in the back of the turtle truck. So I'm glad we got to the bottom of that. Sal, I can't thank you enough. Well, folks, you can find out all sorts about Sal, just a quick Google search, and you'll find out more than you'd ever love to know about Sal Fish and all the great work he did in Baja. I'm touched that you've actually, you have a home in Baja, and you have a home in La Paz, as I understand.
Yes, I do.
So in the most Mexican of places in Baja, the fewest amount of gringos, the place that's really warmed my heart now with what's going on in the Malecón, and how, you know, it's really a beautiful, there's a lot of pride in La Paz these
days.
Without
a doubt. And, you know, you can imagine, I not only know that I've been in every place in the mainland, I've had the opportunity to spend a month traveling to the Yucatan Peninsula, and I certainly know Baja, I'll tell you that, in Baja Sur. And I can't think of a better place, and that's why my wife and I purchased the place in La Paz when we did almost 30 years ago. It's just the most, I love the water, you know, right on the bay there. In fact, I'm leaving a week from, 2 days from now, Saturday or whatever it was, to go down for a month. And I love to kayak, and I love to see all my friends down there, and I will do some off-roading while I'm there, but not a lot. Mostly, I like being in the kayak and just the Sea of Cortez. It's 82 degrees right now, and the Pacific is nice. You know, because we're looking at the Pacific right here, but I don't go in my kayak in this water.
Sure.
Out here.
Sure.
Out there, I get in, put a couple of cans of Tecate and some salami, and I'm gone for the day. And Barbara knows I'll come back, because I never go further than I could swim or walk in the beautiful water of the Sea of Cortez.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. Normally, for appearing on the Slow Baja Show, my guests get the beautiful Benchmark Baja Road and Recreation Atlas. today, because Sal is kind of known as a tequila aficionado, I sequestered a bottle of Fortaleza and brought it back for me for this special occasion. So salutes to you. Saludos to you, senor. You have a beautiful bottle of Fortaleza Blanco, and I sincerely hope our paths cross again soon. So thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Michael. And I know they will, and I am going to treasure the bottle, and you know I am going to drink it. We are going to toast here. I know you have a drive ahead of you.
Well, I have a slow Baja shot glasses here for you that I'll leave with this beautiful bottle. We'll just have a little sip to say saludos. So thank you.
Salute.
We did it. Have I told you about my friend True Miller? You've probably heard the podcast, but let me tell you, her vineyard, Adobe Guadalupe Winery, is spectacular. From the breakfast at her communal table, bookended to an intimate dinner at night, their house-bred Azteca horses, Solomon the Horseman, will get you on a ride that'll just change your life. The food, the setting, the pool, it's all spectacular. AdobeGuadalupe.com. For appearing on Slow Baja today, our guests will receive the beautiful Benchmark Map 72-page Baja Road and Recreation Atlas. Do not go to Baja without this, folks. You never know when your GPS is going to crap out, and you're going to want a great map in your lap. Trust me. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. Sal is just a delightful human being, and I really feel lucky to have spent some time recording a few stories from his extraordinary life. If you enjoyed the conversations you heard this year on Slow Baja, that's right, this year. It's already another year has slipped by. It's already the holidays. New Year's is upon us. You may even be listening to this show in the new year. If you've enjoyed what you heard this year on Slow Baja, please take a second. Support the show. A huge shout out, huge thanks to Eric Lippincott at Camp Tech for his support. He slid an entire tray of tacos into the tank this week, and it just made my day. Really got to say thanks to him. If you're thinking about putting a pop top in your modern-ish Land Cruiser, FJ80 and newer, maybe your GX470 like Carter at Nomad Wheels had popped into his, or maybe you want to do it in your Gen 5 4Runner, well, Eric at Camp Tech is your dude. So thanks, Eric, for your support. Check him out. And if you want to drop a taco in my tank like Eric did, click the donate button at slowbaja.com, pick your dollar amount, and securely enter your payment information. It's pretty fast, it's pretty easy, and it is the best way to get my coveted Ask Your Doctor If Baja Is Right For You bumper sticker. While you're at slowbaja.com, you better check out the Slow Baja shop. There's still merch, folks. I can't believe it. There's still merch. I've got the Slow Baja sweatshirts in stock. I've got some knit hats, not very many, but a few. I still have white t-shirts in all sizes, and I have the modern trucker hat in all three flavors. So check it out. Buy some merch for your Slow Baja friend, fan, what have you. Share the message. Share the show. And I will be back soon, probably early next year, 2023, with a brand new show. And until then, in the words of Mary McGee's pal, Steve McQueen, Baja's life. Whatever happens before or after is just waiting.